right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our very first ever Torah Studies class at the Beltline. This is a very special holiday edition because it's Erev Thanksgiving. And
is that a holiday?
It could be. It's Erev the holiday. It's also the eve of the 14th of Kislev, which is the anniversary of the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. It's 90 years since the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin got married in Warsaw. So it's a special day on the Jewish calendar, on the Chabad calendar. And we're dedicating this class, and I think for the next while, we're dedicating our classes to a very dear friend who passed away, Jeff Moshe Kraus, who many of you knew, even if you don't know him by name, but he used to come to the classes, he used to come to Shul. And he passed away very tragically and unexpectedly this past weekend. So we're dedicating the Torah that we're studying to his memory and to his neshama. And his neshama should have only a continued ascent and be in a good place. So let's begin. Every human being struggles with something. And it's usually, when I say something, I'm being generous. It's usually more than, or not generous, because it's usually more than something. We all struggle. And each of us has a different type of Yetzer Hara and Nefesh HaBahamas. I'll translate. Each of us has a different type of evil inclination and animal soul. No two animal souls are alike. No two evil inclinations are alike. In fact, and here's how you know. Here's how you can know this for a fact. You ever looked at somebody and thought to yourself, or assessed somebody and thought to yourself, man, why can't they just get their act together and, you know, not do that, or do that, or whatever it is, or get over that issue that they have? You ever thought to yourself that?
A lot.
Why do, huh?
Never.
Okay, so why do we think that?
So, people have thought that about me.
Right. So if not us, then about us, or others about others, whatever it is. So the question is, why do we do this? And the answer is very simple. It's a beautiful answer. And it's because the other person's evil inclination is not yours. And therefore, it's easy for you to master those temptations. In other words, that evil inclination or animal soul that's tempting the other person is not yours. So for you, it's easy to master that one. And therefore, you look at that person and say, well, why can't you just, how hard is that? To just hold yourself back, or to just conquer that, or to just do that and not be so lazy. It's easy to conquer someone else's challenges because they're not yours. And because they're not yours, they're not made for you. In other words, everyone, every single human being has challenges that are specifically designed for you, for the person, him or herself, without exception. Every single one of us has an evil inclination, an animal soul, that knows just the right buttons to push to make things very difficult, to make it difficult to do the right thing, and to make it very tempting to do the wrong thing. And again, someone else's matches their personality or their mission, and it's easier for you to master it. Which is why looking at other people is a profound waste of time. Because you can live in a space of, oh, come on, I'm so much better than that. I could totally do that. Why can't they do that? You can live your life focused on what others are where others are failing and feel good about yourself. But the question is not, you know, if you would be in their shoes, what would you do? That's a meaningless exercise. The question is being in our own shoes, living exactly as we are, who we are, where we are. Are we doing what we need to? Are we conquering our inclination, the challenges that we have? And the truth is, it's not easy. And each of us, as I mentioned, each of us has an animal soul and an evil inclination, a nefesh abahamit and a yetzer hara that is exactly tweaked and programmed to cause us the biggest challenges. And it's along these lines that we encounter a question. The question that we're going to begin, again, this is not yet connected to our Torah portion. Torah portion this week is Vayishlach, but we're not yet connecting it till after we ask this fundamental question. The fundamental question is it possible for a person to say that they just simply cannot conquer their inclination, They cannot conquer the negative inclination. They cannot conquer their animal soul. It's just too powerful, or it's just too big, too difficult. Is that a valid perspective? Exactly. Right. Let's begin with this idea articulated in text one. And I'll tell you where text one comes from. One of the fundamental Chabad Hasidic texts was written by the fifth Chabad Rebbe. You know what? I want to give an introduction, a preamble to this preamble as well. Very interesting. So there were seven Chabad Lubavitch Rebbes. Or Rebbes. The Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, the Mittler Rebbe, Rabbi Dov Ber, there was the Tzemach Tzedek, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, there was the Rebbe Marash, Rabbi Shmuel, there was the Rebbe Rashab, Rabbi Shalom Dov Ber, the previous Rebbe, known as the Friedeker Rebbe, the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, and of course our Rebbe, again, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, Schneerson. And each one taught in a unique way. Each one had their own way of teaching and their own style of communicating. So some taught very short teachings, more cryptic and short, abbreviated. Some taught very broadly and expansively. Some were more intellectual, some were more emotional. Some had a bridge of the two. The fifth Rebbe, Rabbi Shalom Dov Ber Schneerson of Lubavitch, so known as the Rebbe Rasha, where text one, the author of text one, he had a wonderful synthesis, if we could analyze, in a sense, his teachings of Chassidut, he had a wonderful synthesis of the intellectual and the emotional. So when you study it, it's not just like a philosophical question or a philosophical answer, it's something that really touches the heart. And in most Chabad yeshivot, the Chassidut that studied, the Chassidus that studied, is from the fifth Rebbe. Like the main anchor Chassidic discourses are studied from the Rebbe Rashab. He was also the founder of the Chabad Yeshiva movement, known as Tomchei Tumim, so that might also be a reason why, you know, his teachings got into the curriculum. But be that as it may, and once it's there, it's there. But really, the anchor discourses, when you study in the morning, you know, 7:30 to 9 a.m., you study the deep set of discourses, it's usually from the Rebbe Rashab. This comes, so that's an introduction about him. Now, about this text, it's called Kuntres Umayon, and the English translation that we worked on when I used to work for the publisher, we called Overcoming Folly. Overcoming Folly. It talks the entire discourse, and it's multiple chapters. It's a really thick book. It talks predominantly about the different stories we tell ourselves that get us in trouble. It's all about the stories that we tell ourselves that trip us up. Like, well, you know what? I may be doing this thing wrong now, but I'll fix it up later. Or, it's not so bad. Everyone does it. Or, it's not so bad. I deserve it. After all that, I'm going to do it anyway. Or, whatever. All the different excuses. About a dozen. I don't remember how many. 6, 8, 10, 12 different excuses, which in Hebrew, we would call shtuyot. How would you translate shtuyot?
Nonsense.
Nonsense, right? That's the whole point. Shtuyot. So in our minds, it makes perfect sense. I got the perfect excuse why I should do something. But if you look at it later, you're thinking, oy, what was I thinking? What was I doing? Shtuyot. It's foolishness. It's ridiculous. What was I thinking? Okay, so the point of this text is to kind of get us thinking clearly before we make the negative choices, etc. So here's one of the things that a person might tell themselves to excuse themselves. Text number one. Tim.
There are times that the Balai Teshuva, though bitterly remorseful for the original misdeed, still finds some exoneration for themselves, some excuse.
Again, remember, this whole text is about finding excuses. He says this is an excuse that somebody who was involved in negative behavior now is actually on a better path. Balei Teshuva means those that have come back, returned to a better path, but they still might exonerate themselves for the past behavior by saying the following.
It may be his passionate nature that was at fault, one might feel. It was so strong that he was unable to restrain his temper or his speech or thought from saying or thinking about something forbidden. If he sinned indeed, he contends that he could not control himself, though he realized that it was forbidden, that it would destroy his soul and possibly harm him physically. But alas, his passion was not to be denied.
So he says, look, I knew that it was wrong, but what can you do? God gave me a very passionate animal soul, a very strong evil inclination.
That's
so
the way I am.
That's the way I am. This is the old that's the way I am excuse. Or, I don't know, whatever it is. That's the old, that's the way I am. You know, I guess excuse is a good word. Okay, so what do we do about that? On some level, it's true. God did give us an animal soul, and it did give us an evil inclination, and specifically designed and trained to trip us up. So maybe a person legitimately can say and excuse himself, saying, this is who I am, what do you want me to do? So how do we deal with this? I think intuitively we know that that can't be an excuse. It doesn't sound right, but how do we explain it? So what we're going to do tonight is really take a very mystical exploration. We're going to talk about primordial worlds. We're going to talk about worlds of chaos and worlds of repair, tohu and tikkun. We'll talk about shvirat hakelim, the shattering of the vessels. We're not going to break anything. This is a new building. But we'll talk about the...
It's all plastic, right?
Yeah, had God known about plastic, we wouldn't have this whole shvirat hakelim business. Anyway, so we'll talk about the shattering of the vessels. We'll talk about the spiritual origins of Esav and Yaakov and animal soul and godly soul and animals and human beings. And there's going to be an incredible exploration. And then we're going to understand how it fits into the context of our discussion about how strong is the inner animal versus the divine soul that we possess. To do this, we're going to take what seems to be a bit of a detour, but of course it's not. The detour would be in our Torah portion. So please open up your Chumash to the Torah portion of Vayishlach. You can find it here on page 210 and 211. There should be more or less enough copies. If not, share a little bit. Sharing is caring, whatever, either way. All right, page 210. And I want to walk, before we read this inside, I want to walk you through some of the narrative of this week's Torah portion, just to get a quick overview, and then we're going to jump into the main text that is really interesting. Okay, the Torah portion begins with Jacob, heading home. He's heading home after 20 or 22 years, and he is very apprehensive about his encounter with his twin brother Esau, because the last time he met him, the latter wanted to kill him. Not the latter with a D, but with a T. So he prepares for this encounter in three ways. He prays, he sends gifts, and he prepares. For war. The famous encounter happens in the interim between Yaakov, Jacob, and the guardian angel of Esav, where they fight and they struggle at night. He's victorious as Jacob over the angel. Jacob then confronts Esau, and they hug it out, and all is, at least on the surface, all civility and fraternity is restored. In fact, it's to the point where Esau says to Yaakov, Esau says to Jacob, why don't you join me? Why don't we live together? Kumbaya it up. Let's create a kibbutz, and all live together. This, you know, in theory. And Jacob says, the kids are young, and the cattle is the cattle, and it's going to take us a while. You go ahead. You go ahead, and we'll get there eventually. And to justify Jacob's words, we say, it's been taught, that when will Jacob finally go there, go meet up with Esau, when Mashiach comes, va'olu Moshiim, lahar Tzion, lishpot et har Esav, v'hayta l'Hashem hamlucha. It says that then, in the Messianic era, we'll go up to the Mount Seir. Sorry, Esav. All right, whatever. I said it in the Hebrew. Now I need to translate it in my head. Whatever, that there's going to be this reunion of the Jewish people and the descendants of Esav, and it's going to be one big, huge kumbaya. Okay, after that, we have the abduction of Dinah, the daughter of Yaakov, the daughter of Jacob. Dinah is abducted. And her brothers restore her by wiping out a city. As they say in ancient times, no big deal. It was a very big deal. Okay, then we have Yaakov's name is officially changed. Yaakov becomes Yisrael. Binyamin is born in 233, and his mother, Rachel, passes away. Okay, and then finally 235, that's what we want to get to. At the end of the Torah portion, chapter 36, the entire chapter 36 of Bereshit of Genesis talks about Esau's family tree. And it's interesting because most of us reading the Torah at this point, when I say most of us, I mean like literally us reading it, probably don't really care about Esau's family tree. I mean, I think, I don't know. I don't remember ever thinking to myself, well, what happened with Esau at the end? Like, what? I know he went ahead and whatever, but like, what was his tree, what family tree look like? Like, what? Who were his grandkids? What happened with that? And yet the Torah spends, takes up an entire chapter, chapter 36, two times sky, of Genesis, of Bereshit, and dedicates it to exploring Esau's descendants. Here's what I want to do. I want to read it inside in the Torah Studies text, just because they pared it down to those texts that are relevant to our discussion. But here's what you need to know. It charts the family tree, and then it charts the descendants of Esau, of Esau, who were kings in the land of Edom, which is adjacent to the land of Israel. There were kings of Edom before, as the Torah puts it, before there were any Jewish kings in the land of Israel. So this happened in ancient times, so to speak, even before the Jewish people would settle into to the land of Israel. Okay, so let's read this inside. Text number two. Mike, please take it away. Hey, by the way, it's nice to have a situation where when I say Mike, we don't know who we're talking about.
No,
Mike, good to see you back.
Mike the Elder.
Mike, well, if you like that, I don't call anyone nicknames without express permission. 127.
And these are the generations of Esau. That is Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. So Esau dwelt on Mount Seir. Esau, that is Edom.
Yeah.
And these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Bela, son of Beor, reigned in Edom. And the name of his city was Dinhabah. Bela died, and Jobab, I like that.
Jobab.
That's probably not pronounced that way. Son of Zerah, son of Basra, reigned in his stead. And Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites reigned in his stead. Husham died, and Hadad, son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the field of Moab, reigned in his stead. The name of the city was Avith. Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekha reigned in his stead. Samla died, and Saul of Rehoboth by the river reigned in his stead. Saul died, and Baal-Hanan, son of Achbor, reigned in his stead. Baal-Hanan, son of Achbor, died, and Hadar reigned in his stead. The name of the city was Pu'u. His wife's name was Mehetabel, daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab.
So, thank you. Sorry for breaking your teeth, not making you break your teeth on that. But these are like, but how, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how compelling is that narrative right there?
Zero.
Right? It's not that, okay, and that's Torah. So we have, it's part of Torah, and if a Torah, if a scroll is missing this, it's not kosher. So it's Torah, but come on, it's not compelling. It's like, when was, again, as I asked before, what? Are we really missing, like, oh, I need to know what happened with Esau's, you know, family tree. I need to know, like, okay, you know.
Well, they were human beings, and they had human relationships and human emotions and suffered human frailties.
Yeah, 100%. But here's the thing. Torah, look, if Torah is a history book, it does a really lousy job. Because it's just really... It's really bad. It's a really bad history book. I mean, you have Abraham is born in the year 1948. The Exodus happens in 2448. So you have there a span of 500 years. That's almost this whole book. What's happened? What happens before? I guess you could have a history book that focuses on one era. I don't know. But it's very. Torah is not a history book. Torah doesn't claim to be a history book. It doesn't give us the narratives of all the things and dialogue and everything. It doesn't. It picks and chooses what it tells us. Torah is primarily a book of instruction. In fact, the word Torah means teaching and instruction. Torah is a life manual. It's our life instruction manual. So if this narrative is in here, there has to be a message for us. It can't just be, you know, giving us Esau's family tree before we focus on Yaakov's family tree and the rest of the book being about the children of Israel. So let's throw in a little bit of Esau, and then we're done with that whole chapter, and then we move on from here on out with the Jewish people, which it appears to do that, but it can't just be that. There has to be some sort of instruction. Take a look at Ramban. Nachmanides, text 3, gives a very interesting angle. We're not going to stick with Ramban, just because we want to explain on a mystical level, but he gives, on a basic level, gives a very interesting explanation. Sorry, yeah.
And these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom. The Torah records this to tell us that the blessing of Isaac, who told his son Esau that you shall live by your sword, was fulfilled. Since Esau and his descendants, the Edomites, prevailed over the sons of Seir, the Horite, and ruled over them in their own land.
So this gets into a little bit of a geographic discussion. Ramban says that if you look at where these kings, these descendants of Esau, ruled, it wasn't necessarily directly in their own land. They ruled actually in other people's lands, which tells us that the blessing that Isaac gave to Esau, that Yitzhak gave to Esau, which is that you will live by your sword, was fulfilled, because his descendants who were kings, they were very mighty, and they were able to conquer other nations in those lands that were not their own. Continue, please.
The cities of origin provided in the list are settlements of the land of Edom. Basra belongs to the Edomites, as it is written, for God has a sacrifice in Basra, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. And so it is with all of the other cities being Edomite settlements. However, the Torah also recounts that the kings were not dynastic as they were in Israel.
And what does that mean, dynastic?
The family?
It wasn't in the family. In the original Hebrew, ki lo hayu melech ben melech. The royalty, the monarchy, it wasn't a king and his son and his son. If you look at the list that Mike read before, it was one king rose, and then he died, and someone else of the land of the Tamanites, of the field, whatever. People rose to become the king, others rose, and each one was taken by whoever jumped up to get it. Which again reminds us that Esau's calling card, if you will, is the idea of living by the sword. So living by the sword, and the crown is taken by those who are the mightiest and the strongest. Again, it's by the sword. It's a very rough and tumble thing. So not only did they conquer other lands that were not natively their own, but even their royalty was conquered one from the other. Make sense? So the point of this is, according to Ramban, is to kind of round up the discussion, or kind of wrap up the discussion of the blessings that Yitzchak, Isaac, gave to his sons. How were they fulfilled? The blessings to Yaakov, to Jacob, play out in the rest of the story. And the blessing to Esau, which is you will live by your sword, that was also, we see some allusions to that here, so it's kind of just wrapping that up. But we're not going to be satisfied with that answer. Not that it's not a good answer, but we're going to look on a much deeper level, on a completely different plane of understanding, to reinterpret, to reimagine what the Torah's intent is, or what some of the underlying messages are with these kings that rose and died and rose and died and rose and died. To understand this, we're going to explore one of the major teachings of Kabbalah, especially the teachings of Luriana Kabbalah. When I say Luriana Kabbalah, that is the teachings of Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, known as the Arizal. Now, the Arizal lived in the 1500s. The Arizal is one of the greatest Kabbalists. He's one of the greatest Kabbalists who ever lived. And he, in a sense, introduced a new way of mystical, a new avenue, a new pathway of mystical understanding, mystical teachings. And he introduced a lot of things that you and I take for granted, not only in the mystical tradition, if you've studied Kabbalah, but even in a global, just on a very general societal level, things, phrases, catchwords that you and I use all the time were introduced by the Arizal and his teachings. For example, most famous one that I can cite now is Tikkun Olam, which is the idea, the social movement of fixing the world, or it's become a social movement. That originates, that concept of Tikkun Olam begins with the Arizal. And tonight we're going to talk about a little bit about these origins. What is Tikkun what does repair really mean, and what is the mystical foundation of that. So the Arizal teaches that before our universe, before our reality, God created another reality. And this reality didn't last. So the universe that we love and know, this is 2.0. There was a creation 1.0. The fate of that creation was it crashed and burned. In the language of the Arizal, this is Shvirat HaKelim. The vessels broke. What's the vessels and how did they break and what does that mean? So in Kabbalah, everything has everything in existence or every concept, anything is an interplay between light and vessel. One of the examples that I can give is the example of a word. Think of a word, a three-letter word. The word is cat. Okay? C-A-T in English. We'll do this in English. C-A-T, cat. So if I tell you the word cat, what do you think of? A cat. A cat, right? And I feel like an animal. Okay. Fine. So if you look at the written word cat, C-A-T, the letters themselves are what we would call the vessel, and the meaning of the word cat, the animal, would be the light in the vessel. In other words, language always has the interplay between light and vessel, which is basically content and container. Right? What is the content and what's it being held in? So if a teacher, giving another example, I'll give you an analogy of an analogy. If a teacher gives an example for a concept, the example, and I'm doing one right now, the analogy is a container, and the analog, what it means is the content in the container. Again, in the language of the mystics, it's light and vessel. Okay, so the way it's described in Kabbalah, the first universe, the first creation, the way it's described is that there was a lot of light and only a little bit of vessel. So the lights were big and the vessels were small. To give you an example, again, here's the idea, and I'm packaging it into a container. So I'm taking light and putting it into a vessel with this example again. What's the example that I'll give? So imagine you fill up your cup. We have the water machine here? We don't have the water. We have a hot water machine. So imagine we had the water cooler thing, and you take a cup and you put it onto the water cooler, and it dispenses water, and you pull it out, and it's good. What if you had a fire hose that has water in it, fresh water, let's say, but a fire hose with incredible force, and you take a paper cup, and you turn it on, and you hold your cup in front. What's going to happen to the cup? It's going to destroy it. It's going to smash it. Why? Because the water is too strong for the vessel. Okay. So in a similar context, I'll give you another example. Imagine a teacher is teaching students a very lofty concept. Young students, a very, very deep concept. Assuming that the kids are at their age level and grade level, and assuming the teacher is teaching on a much, much higher level, right? Notwithstanding, right? Forget exceptions, but on average, are the kids, is that class understanding what the teacher is saying? What's happening with the information?
It's flying over their heads.
So on one level, we could say it's flying over their heads. Can we imagine a scenario where it's actually not only over their heads, but it can actually, I'm trying to find the right language here, harm or hurt or confuse. Could it confuse the students and cause more trouble than good? 100%. These are all examples of what we call Shvirat HaKelim. When the recipient or the container or whatever it is not big enough to contain what you're putting into it, not only will it not contain it, it can actually harm the keli, the vessel. It can actually harm it. So whether it's the cup being destroyed or the student being confused, it can cause some sort of damage or some sort of harm. Okay. Let's read text 4. Text 4 is where this idea so let me just give you... So the first universe that God creates is called, in Kabbalah, Olam HaTohu, which is the world of Tohu, not Tofu, that's something else, the world of Tohu, T-O-H-U in English at least, T-O-H-U, Tohu, which is literally translated as the world of chaos. Why chaos? because again, it was just too big light for small vessels, and things were breaking all over the place. It was chaos. It was chaotic. The second universe that God creates, the second modality of creation, is called Olam HaTikun, world of repair. We live in the world of repair, and we're not only living in a world in which the light is small. When was the last time you saw God's revelation? Probably it's been a while, right? What do we see outside? We see the Beltline, we see Midtown, we see Pot City Market. These are just buildings, right? But you see tables, and we see tea, and we see bricks. We don't see God. We see stuff. Okay. So the lights are diminished, and the vessels are broad, right? There's lots of vessels, and only a little bit of light. You can't even find the light sometimes if you look for it. That's the world that we live in, not physical light, spiritual light, divine light. So our world is a world in which the world can exist and it doesn't explode. The world of tikkun. It's also called tikkun because our job is to be mitakein, to fix the shattered vessels that broke in the first go-around. Why? Because, and here's the last piece before we read text 4, the last piece of introduction. When the vessels, so to speak, the vessels of the world of tohu shattered, those fragments went and embedded themselves and become part of out the fabric of our tikkun universe. The higher the vessels, the lower they fell. That's the way it works. So these vessels, metaphorically shattered, these shards, so to speak, embedded themselves deep in the earth, in the world, in the physical world, not the physical earth, but not also, but in, around the world, around this universe. And our job, each of us, our job is to find and rectify and repair those sparks of divine reality that shattered and fell into the lows of spaces by utilizing everything that we come across for a higher purpose. And that's what we call tikkun olam, fixing the world, repairing the world by fixing the shards.
Yeah. And just to be, the shards actually fell from Olam HaTohu?
The Olam HaTohu. So not only did they fall, but according to Kabbalah, the shattered vessels of Tohu become the underlying fabric of this reality. Not the lights of our reality, of this current reality. Not the lights. The lights were too big. But the vessels that absorbed some of the light and then broke, those shattered vessels become the foundation of this universe.
So in a sense, the foundation of our universe is
broken vessels
out of the world of chaos.
Correct. Correct. So it's one continuum. And it wasn't a mistake.
The two universes are actually connected.
100%. And it wasn't a mistake. It's not like God like mixed the wrong, exploded. Let's try again. Go less on that light. It wasn't a mistake. It was intentional. In other places in Kabbalah, it's explained very, very, very carefully why Tohu was needed before Tikkun. In other words, how do you get from spiritual reality to physical reality if not through some dramatic episode? Because if you have a gradual reduction of spirituality, you're never going to hit physical material. In other words, if I explain to you a car and I describe it in every detail, I will never get to the point where I actually create a car. In other words, no matter how well I depict it, it's never going to cross over the line between imagination and description and a physical car. Are you with me? Right? You read a book and the characters come to life. Slow it down. They're not actually coming to life. In a story, they're coming to life. But there's always an unbridgeable gap between the narrative, if you will, and the concept and the physical the physical manifestation of such. So conceptually, if God concretizes spiritual reality, you're still never going to hit physical. So something dramatic had to happen. Something had to break. Something had to be completely altered or shattered, whatever you call it, right? Something dramatic had to happen to produce and to form the origins of a physical universe. And so what's the core of this physical universe? The shards, if you will, not physical shards, but the conceptual shards, spiritual shards, whatever it is, of the world of Tohu. And so that's how the results brings everything together. And so each of us is on a mission to find these shard sparks and lift them back up to God and to elevate them, and that's what we call Tikkun Olam in the original sense. Now it's become any movement that's a good movement has become Tikkun Olam, but in its original core articulation, it's about spiritual task, basically spiritual spiritual mission of not hide and seek, but finding that which is hidden. Okay, so now let's read this inside text number 4. Mike.
God wants the world to benefit his creations and that they should recognize his greatness and merit, to become an instrument of heaven and cleave to him. In doing so, he emanated a single point that included 10 points that were not visible. This is called the world of chaos and emptiness.
Tohuvavohu.
The world of points.
And by the way, the chaos and emptiness, Tohuvavohu, is actually a quote from the beginning of Genesis. It says, Va'aretz hayta Tohuvavohu. The world was chaos and empty. And then it says God formed. So the Arizal, Rabbi Chaim Vital was a student who wrote down his teachings, but it's taught by the Arizal. The Arizal was his teaching that in the beginning, when the Torah says that the world was chaos and void, or chaos and empty, this is an allusion to this primordial reality that existed before the world as we know it. So God formed from that what we know now. Continue.
Inasmuch as the supernal emanator saw that these vessels broke on account of the great light they contained, but could not bear, his desire to repair all of the worlds so that they could bear this light. He desired to repair all of the worlds so that they could bear this light. He did so by diffusing the light and distancing them from the supernal emanator so that the lights would come more concealed. Thus, the worlds would be sustainable and able to bear the light.
So in this understanding of it, in a simple sense, again, this could be misconstrued, but in a simple sense, God, the light was too big, oops, it broke, so God is now dimming the light to make it sustainable. But again, it's not a mistake, it was intentional, as I explained before. Okay, to give you a human example of this, a very simple example. What went wrong in the world of Tohu? This will be very important. The world of Tohu is known as the world of emotion. Although it says there are 10 points of light because there are 10 sefirot, but it's a world that's dominated by emotion. And what happens with emotion? Emotions are very strong and powerful. And somebody might be chesed, love, somebody might be gvura, discipline, somebody might be teferet, compassion, somebody might be netzach, which is ambition, somebody might be hod, which is humility, etc. You have polar, when it comes to emotions, you have very, very opposite emotions. I'll give you an example. You know, politics sometimes drives people apart, right? Have you heard this? Have you heard the rumors?
No, never heard that.
Never heard the rumors.
When I was younger,
it's been, yeah, not now. Now it's peaceful. But some of you may know of this concept or may know of this technology. It's called Facebook. And what happens on Facebook is somebody posts something, like political or whatever, like a hot take, and the next thing you know, there's fireworks. What's happening? You're watching Tohu unfold. You're watching a world of chaos unfold. What's going on? Everyone is shouting their point, and there are no gaps that are being bridged. So it's like Tohu is known as pure chesed, pure gvura, pure teferet, each of the emotional attributes is full force, tweaked 100% with no allowance to stand for the other. So it's the world of, in the language over here, it's the world, I think it says Nekudim. Does it say that here? It should say that here. If it doesn't, we may have to add that in. I'm kidding. Yeah, Nekuda. Nekudim, Shalah, Hakudim, Akudim, whatever. It's a world of points. Each point, there are no lines connecting. Have you ever seen the Sphero chart where you have like right, left, center, like triangles and everything? Have you seen that Sphero chart? Divine emanations, chesed, gevura, teferet, with lines. That's the world of tikkun, that's the world of repair. That's where everyone can get along. It's like chesed knows that pure kindness without discipline is no good, because then you're giving a kid a knife when they ask to cut the cake, and maybe it's too sharp, maybe you have to say no, because that's also love. So chesed knows gevura. And gevura says, well, why am I gevuring? Why am I withholding? It's only because I love. So ultimately, it's founded in chesed. So if they understand their own place and how they need each other, they can coexist, and it's fine. So I may have, I'm about to tread into really terrible water. I don't know why I'm doing this. It's crazy. I can't hold myself back to X1. I can't do it. No, I'm kidding. I'm just thinking to this, like.
It's just the way you are.
Yeah, just the way I am. I don't even know what I was going to say anymore after all that stuff. Something about politics. I don't know. I lost my train of thought. Okay, here's the point. If each one is on its own and sees itself as 100% and the be-all and end-all, then it sets up for conflict. And that's when things shatter. That's when things break. Relationships break down and things smash. When things are driven not by emotion, but by mindfulness, by careful, methodical thinking, so then rational thought, so then rationality can say, look, you may feel strongly about that opinion, but they feel strongly about their opinion. And maybe there's truth there as well. In other words, pure seichel, pure logic, can understand a davar v'hifucho, can understand something and its opposite. It can understand the logic behind this argument and that argument, unless you're emotionally invested in one, and then it becomes, this is it. But pure logic, logic doesn't only dictate one way. A philosopher can say this way and that way, right? Pure philosophy, pure logic. It can go either way. God said, I'm going to destroy the world, bring a flood. Why? Because human beings are evil from their youth. After the flood, I'll never destroy the world again. Why? What are you going to do? People are evil from their youth. What? Exactly. God says, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people after the sin of the golden calf. They're a stiff-necked people. Moses says, don't destroy them. Why? They're a stiff-necked people. They're going to be stubborn and stick to you forever. Okay, both are right. Logic can go both ways. Pure logic. Without an emotional anchor, without an emotional bias, could go either way. So the world of Tohu is ruled by the seven emotions. Seven emotions. And because of that, and each emotion is tweaked 100%. There's no coexistence. My way. Ugh, that's not sustainable. It's unsustainable. The world of Tikkun is a world, hopefully, where mindfulness reigns. It doesn't always feel like this. It feels sometimes we live in a world of Tohu again. But anyway, this world is meant to be a world where seichel, where intelligence, where intellect rules, where mindfulness reigns supreme, where we can say, I feel this way, you feel that way, we can agree to disagree, I see your opinion, you see mine, but we can all coexist. Okay. So if you had to compare and contrast the twin brothers, Jacob and Esau, who seems to be more, based on what we know, based on the profiles that we know from the Torah and from other commentaries in the Midrashim and the Talmud, who would seem to be more of the emotional character and who more of the intellectual character?
Esau.
Esau is emotional, right? He was born fiery red. He was a hunter. He lived by his sword. Very emotional and powerful. And Jacob, what do we know about Yaakov? Ish tam, Yoshev Olam. He was a simple guy who sat in the tent and studied all day. Emotion or intellect? Mm-hmm. Intellect. So Yaakov, you know, Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus, you remember that book? Esav is from Tohu. Yaakov is from Tikkun. Again, Esav is Tohu. What's Tohu? Chaos. Emotion. Volatility. Esav is your volatile guy. You always need a volatile guy just to keep things fun, right? Esav is your party animal. He's your volatile guy. Yaakov is a cerebral type. He's a studious guy. He's doing things right. Until his mother tells him to wear his brother's clothes and take a blessing. He says, are you sure, Ma? Do it. He does it because he's obedient. Right? He's kind of more the in-the-box type of guy. He's Tikkun. So Tohu and Tikkun. Fantastic. Now we can skip text 5 because I just said that. So text 5 is, again, another mystical source that basically draws the line between the world of Tohu to Esav, to Esau, and the world of Tikkun, repair, to Jacob. So far, so good. I'm using a lot of the mystical terminology and the Hebrew terminology. I apologize if it gets confusing at any point.
But Esav's light was...
bigger. Yeah. Oh, yep. Here we go. What is more powerful? The emotional, volatile person or the cerebral, studious fellow? Who's got more passion? The emotional guy. So who has more light? I'm not saying greater light. Who has more light? Tohu had more light than Tikkun, right? We live in a world where we don't see the light. Again, that's spiritual light. But if we just translate it into human beings and emotions and Jacob and Esau, Esau has a lot of light. In a sense, he has a lot of passion, a lot of stuff. And Jacob is more of the calmer fellow. Now, Kabbalah explains, this is text 6 now, paraphrases. Text 6 explains that, remember the text, who read text number 1? No, text number 2, Mike, that was you. You read about all the kings reigning and dying, right? Okay. How many kings died, reigned and died? 7. How many emotions are there? 7. Kabbalah says, the 7 kings of Esav, the 7 descendants of Esav who were kings, who rose to power and ruled Edom and then died, are a symbol of the 7 emotional powers of the world of Tohu, the world of chaos, that each one rose and then was shattered. That's their death. Are you with me on this? The imagery of the world of chaos, each light of the 7 emotions bursting, it's almost like flaming out because it's so powerful. It can't tolerate everyone else. It pushes itself, and then because of that, it just explodes. These are the 7 kings. Remember, they were not dynastic. Each one fought for the throne, and then ultimately they died. Now, they died. There's no indication that they died of like light overload, but the point is, in Jewish mysticism, this is understood as an allegory to the, as a metaphor to this idea of the world of Tohu. Take a look at text number 6. Again, Ruchaim Vital, this has come from the Arizal. Alex, please read this one, but just please read this, the last paragraph where it says, these are the 7 kings.
These are the 7 kings who died, and each of whom, it is said, and he reigned and he died. First they reigned, and then they died. And these 7 containers were nullified, since they could not bear the light that radiated in them from one sphera to another.
In other words, there was no interconnectedness between the spherot. Their light was too big for them to handle on their own, especially in contrast to the one, to the other light that was there. Each one was vying, each one was volatile, and those lights exploded and shattered the vessels. Okay, so that now we have all the lines drawn. So again, if you're keeping track at home, here's what we have so far. World of chaos, world of repair. Chaos is Esav, repair is Jacob, Yaakov. We have the 7 primordial kings, the 7 kings of Edom who rose to power and then died. Again, underneath that line of chaos, that line of chaos. And that's, again, the emotional side as opposed to the more cerebral, intellectual side. Now, if we had to bring it personalized within the human being, animal soul, godly soul. Animal soul is the volatile self. It's the instinctual, emotional self. Chaos or repair? Chaos. The godly soul knows what's right, not being taken for a fool, is think no shtuyot for the godly soul. Cerebral or emotional?
Cerebral.
Is it repair or chaos?
Tikkun.
It's repair. So each of us has inside of us the two worlds, these two realities of chaos and repair. It's not just some ancient story of creation. It's within each of us. Each of us has these two universes. Gam et ha'olam natan b'libo shel adam, says King Solomon. The world itself is placed in our hands, and not only in our hands, but in our heart. Inside of us, we have these two universes. There's the universe of chaos and the universe of repair. There's the instinctive modality of being, the emotional modality of being, that you said this to me, I'm going to fire back to you. That's all the animal self, and it's the chaotic self. Then you have the menshi self, that says, I know you said that to me. I know you did something wrong to me, but I'm going to be bigger than that. I'm going to take a few breaths, I'm going to breathe in, breathe out. I've got my mantras. I'm going to step out of the room if need be, and I'm going to act like a mensch no matter, despite what's going on around me. That means my mind is in control. Tikkun, I'm in a place of repair. It's tikkun is also correction. I'm correcting any negative emotions within myself. I catch them and correct them, and I'm acting like a mensch. That's the godly soul. Animal soul, godly soul. Which is stronger?
Animal soul.
I'll ask you a question. Which is, you're correct. Which is physically stronger, animal or people?
Animal.
Well, it depends which animal, depends which person, right? But on the, right. The strongest animal is much stronger than the strongest human being. right? That's why cars are measured in horsepower and not people power. I've never heard of somebody saying, oh, it's 1,000 people power. Never happened. Lahaya v'laisiya, never happened. Why? Because horses are stronger, more powerful than human beings. And an ox is even more powerful. And other animals are even more powerful. The strongest animals are physically stronger. Why? Because animals come from the world of Tohu. Tohu precedes, is higher than, and stronger than Tikkun. Tikkun is the ideal state. But which reality, which universe possesses more sheer raw power? Tohu. Tohu possesses the power. So if you look at inside of us, if you look at the animal kingdom, human kingdom, animals are stronger. Within us, we have a human soul, a godly soul, human godly soul, and an animal soul, a lower soul. Which is stronger? Okay, so now remember the question we asked at the beginning of the class? Is it a valid excuse for somebody to say, look, what do you want me to do? God gave me an animal soul and it's really strong. Is that question valid? Have we made it more valid? Have we made it a little bit more valid? Are we trying to make it more valid? Why? By saying, wait a second, not only do we have an evil inclination and an animal soul, but this animal soul in the spiritual origins emanates from the world of Tohu, the primordial world of chaos, which was lots of light, little vessel, right? Anything can set it off, but the point is it's very powerful. So how can little me, little I, how can I combat such little human me, menshi me, combat such a fierce animal power? I can't do it. Of course I tripped up. Of course I messed up. What do you expect giving me such a fierce and ferocious animal inside? This is articulated in text 9a. Text 9a. Look at the caption above text 9a on 135. What does it say? It's not my fault. Why is it not my fault? 9a says, because you gave me not only an animal soul, but you gave me an animal soul that's stronger than my godly soul. The animal's stronger than the human. So what do you want me to do? And text 9b says, you can take this at home to read. I'm just paraphrasing. There's so much in this class. I'm paraphrasing these to get to the point because we're getting close. 9b says, in addition to the animal soul emanating from a higher and more powerful source than the godly soul, in addition to that, which soul is felt and consciously experienced first? Well, I'll ask you a simple question. A baby. Does a baby say, I'm hungry, huh?
I know this one.
Let me ask you, Mike. Does Eli say, right? I'm hungry, feed me now, in his own way, through a cry perhaps? Or does he say, look, I'm hungry, but if I think about it rationally, my mother's tired, my father's tired, I just ate not too long ago, I'll go a few more minutes, I'll go another hour without food, in an hour I'll wake up and then ask for food in a nice way. Does he take a rational approach, the latter, or an emotional, instinctive approach?
I'm going to go with the emotional.
Emotional, instinctive approach, right? Hence the lack of sleep for parents, right? Which always makes you wonder, why do they call it sleeping like a baby? Who had this baby that was sleeping that made up this fake terminology? Sleep like a baby. Yeah, every hour up. Like, what is that? So understand this. This is the significance of Jewish milestones. For example, Bar and Bat Mitzvah. Why is it such a milestone? And it's not about the party. It's about the physical age. Because at 12 or 13, for a girl or for a boy, that's the age in which there's a maturity that happens, which is simply this. The mind now is developed biologically, and then, of course, that triggers, it's all in concert with the spiritual element. The human being is developed enough to hopefully be able to control their inner urges and ask themselves the question, is what I'm doing correct or not correct? And modify their instinctive responses by what they know to be true and correct. That's the responsibility that a bar and bat mitzvah or a bat and bar mitzvah enjoy. The responsibility is, now that you're older, you should know, not know right from wrong. That's easy. I know it's wrong. I'm still going to do it. No, it's not only know it, but be able to modify, there's a better word than modify.
Overcome?
Not overcome, I'm thinking something.
Adapt.
adapt, whatever, somehow manipulate, whatever, change what I'm about to do to fit more with what I know to be true. Fine. So what's the point? Two things. Number one, the animal soul is stronger. Number two, it comes first. It has the first say in my ear. For 12 or 13 years, it's been the loudest voice. After that, you expect me to change so fast? Are you kidding me? What is this? Huh?
Esav
is born first. Oh, exactly. And in the birth order of the twins, Esav, the animal soul, the Tohu, is first. In the worlds, Tohu precedes Tikkun. The animal soul comes before the godly soul. The godly soul is always there, but its voice, its influence is not fully integrated until 12, 13, and then it only starts. It's still not, it's a lifetime of work. And so, therefore, the person might say, a person, you and I might say to God or to ourselves, you know what? What's to be expected of me? God gave me this really strong animal soul. It's stronger than my godly soul. It comes from Tohu. It comes from the emotional realm. It came before my godly soul. What do you really expect? Of course. Folks, thank you for coming tonight. We'll see you. Enjoy life. No, I'm just joking. No. No, we can't end it with an excuse, right? But this is the question. It's asked in Kutra Samayin. This is the question. Text 9a, text 9b is the articulation of this question. And so here's the answer. The answer flips everything on its head. And it's also a very mystical concept, and I'm going to try to make it as understandable as possible. So, okay. In Chassidut, in Chassidic philosophical language, there are two dimensions. There are more than two dimensions, but two dimensions in this area that we're about to speak of. Etzem and Giluyim. What is Etzem? Etzem means essence. Giluyim is revelation. The simple understanding of this is, there's what a thing is, and then there's what a thing appears to be. And those aren't always the same thing. So, for example, you meet someone, and immediately, or not immediately, you speak to them, whatever, you get to know them a little bit. So you have a sense, an idea of who they are based on how they've represented themselves to you, or based on how you've perceived them to be. All of that is not who they actually are. It might be close, it might be very close, but there's no way for you to get into their core essence. I mean, at least not initially, right? So what you see is a manifestation or revelation, an outward projection of either who they want to be seen as or who you think they are seen as, but that's not necessarily who they are in essence. So there's always two dimensions, and Chassidus talks about this. There's Etzem and Giluyim. There's what a thing is, and then what a thing looks like. Giluyim is revelation, how it looks to be, as opposed to what it is. So when it comes to God and divine realities, there's also these two dimensions. Etzem refers to God himself, if you will, like how God exists on his own. Giluyim is how God reveals himself to us. And those are two different realities. There's God's light, the light, the revelation, and the essence. So light, revelation, that's all one category. That's how God is manifest, how God projects, how God expresses, and then who God is himself, in essence. Two different realities. The simple answer, not simple answer, the way the answer to this question, to our attention, the way animal soul seems stronger than the godly soul, the way it's explained simply is like this. When do we say that Tohu, that chaos precedes Tikkun, repair? When do we say that Tohu is more powerful than Tikkun? When do we say that emotion is more powerful than intelligence? When do we say that Esav is stronger than Yaakov? When do we say that the animal soul is stronger than the godly soul? When? All in the world of Giluyim and Revelation has things appear to be. But in essence, the core truth of things, inside of God's design, at its core, it's flipped. The godly soul is stronger than the animal soul. Tikkun is greater than Tohu. Repair is greater than chaos. Jacob is stronger than Esau, etc. Everything is flipped in essence. The best way I can explain it is like this. You look at somebody, you follow somebody, let's say you're a private investigator and you trail somebody for a day. This person goes to work early in the morning, and they spend many hours at their place of business. And then they come home for a few, and then they spend a few hours with the family. Let's say it's the husband, so with his wife and kids. And let's talk about his relationship with his kids. So he greets them when he comes home. He says hi. He says, "How was your day?" Does some homework, eats dinner together, and then helps put them to bed. How many hours does he spend at work? Eight to ten. Let's say 8 to 10. How many hours does he spend with his kids at home?
Two to three,
right? 2 to 4, maybe. Which comes first? Maybe he goes to the office really early in the morning. Which came first? Let's say the work. Where did he invest more effort? Work, right? So by all accounts, the way things appear to be in the world of Revelation, which is stronger, which is more powerful, which is bigger, which is the work over the family. But in a core moment of truth, in essence, which is more meaningful, which is in a healthy situation, which would he sacrifice for the other?
The family.
He would sacrifice the work for the family. The family is the core value that trumps everything else. It's the same thing. The same thing is true when it comes to all of this. The way it emanates, the way it comes out, chaos is before repair, Toes before Tikkun, and Esav is before Yaakov, and that's the way it appears. It's all an appearance. But at its core, in God's essence, which is more precious? Tikkun, repair. Yaakov, Jacob. The godly soul, not the animal soul. At the core essence, all of those other things that appear to be lower or weaker are actually more dear and stronger and more essential.
They have more of a lasting effect. They have a lasting effect.
More of a lasting effect. But the point is like this. If a person says, "I can't because my animal soul comes from Tohu," to that, the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Rebbe, says, "Do you know where your godly soul comes from?" In Revelation, it looks lower, but in God's essence, it's the most dear thing. It's the dearest thing. And therefore, if you really want to go back to its source, you have the power, you have what it takes to overcome even the strongest animal soul. That's the ultimate point here. Let's read this inside. This is really a powerful text, if I can find it. Let's look.
You can even tame the animal soul to serve.
Yeah. Take a look at text 14. This is it. Oh, this is it, the last text. Who are we up to? Anne, are we up to you? Please read text 14, 146 in the English.
If the animal soul and natural passion is very powerful, certainly the godly soul is equipped with even stronger capabilities, enough to overpower that burning corporeal passion. God does not give a person more than he can handle, as our sages say, according to the camel is the load.
Not that anyone's a camel, but nonetheless.
Inasmuch as this person was given a particularly strong natural passion, it stands to reason that he was given even stronger spiritual capabilities to combat these burning temptations. As such, the claim, "My natural temptations are so strong," is rubbish, for his godly soul stems from a lofty place that transcends the animal soul, and with that power, is capable of vanquishing even the strongest material urges.
By the way, the fifth Rebbe didn't use the word rubbish, not even in the Hebrew. He said, "V'im kain batla hataina." He says the excuse is nullified. I'm not happy with this translation. They used it somewhere else where he says it's not true. They said rubbish. It's very sharp. A Rebbe wouldn't teach chassidus like that. But whatever.
Translation, we call this interpretation.
Yeah, and it's trying to make a more bombastic expression, but I think it seems a little bit not nice to use that phrase in here. But whatever, it is what it is. But look what he says in that paragraph. He says, why is that claim nullified? Why can't a person justifiably say, "Well, my evil inclination, my natural temptation is too strong"? Why? Look, you just read it. For his godly soul stems from a lofty place that transcends the animal soul. The animal soul comes from a higher world, whatever. That's all in Revelation. In essence, the godly soul is even higher. Continue, please.
the matter lies only in the person's choice. If he truly wishes to never stray from the divine path, he needs to only call up within himself the powerful force of his godly soul and use it to quash any animalistic urges. The only reason why he may find this mission impossible is simply because he is not sufficiently summoning his godly soul to the task. The matter ultimately lies entirely within to summon the powerful force of the godly soul.
And this is what we'll conclude with, this incredibly optimistic call to action, where the Rebbe says, the fifth Rebbe says, that Ela shezet taloi bebechirat ha'adam, this, all of this depends on our choice. It's our choice. Will we succumb to our natural inclinations and justify and excuse ourselves saying, well, what do you expect? I have such a burning temptation inside. Or will we choose to activate the divine soul that we have inside, to summon and call it forth, recognizing that it is stronger than any other animal, than any of our animalistic urges that seem to lie within? The bottom line answer is, and there was a text or two that spoke about essence versus revelation, which we skipped, but I kind of spoke about it. You can look back at the text. There's a lot of text in this text, in this class. Bottom line is that there are two systems. There's an apparent system, and then there's the true system. The way things appear to be, and then the way things really are. The way they appear to be, the animal is stronger than the human. The animal soul is stronger than the godly soul. That's the way things appear to be. And if you operate by appearances only, then that's the way it might be. But if you know the truth, and the truth is that the godly soul, rooted in God's essence, is stronger in essence than any animal soul could ever be, if you know that to be true, if you believe that to be true, and you call upon that force within, then you can combat any animal urge that comes up. So in summation, the reality is that the stronger our temptations, the more God believes in us, right? Look at it the other way. Don't say, the stronger my temptations, the more of a victim am I to my temptations. What do you want me to do? On the contrary, the stronger my temptations, the more God has believed in us. There's a wonderful story, just a powerful story about a fellow who came to our Lubavitch Rebbe, to the seventh Lubavitch Rebbe, and said, Rebbe, I'm struggling with a certain thing. And he was afraid that the Rebbe was going to like chastise him. What kind of, you're struggling with this? What kind of person are you that you struggle with? Instead, the Rebbe said, I'm jealous of you. He said, jealous of me? Yeah, he says, I've never been given this very deep and dark temptation. It must be because God didn't give me the power to overcome this. But God gave you this temptation. Right, I wouldn't be strong enough to overcome it. That's why God never gave it to me, according to the camel is the load. But you who have this temptation, it's only a proof that God really believes in you and really has given you an incredibly powerful essence, soul essence, godly soul essence. And all you need, it's not all, not to minimize the effort, but what is now demanded of you is to call forth that powerful soul essence and to fight the good fight against the natural urges inside. So again, any temptations that we might have that are negative, that we shouldn't feel overwhelmed, even if it feels overwhelming, we should ultimately know, mindfully know that God has given us a divine soul that can counter anything that comes its way. And so, our Torah portion ends, Vayishlach ends, with a discussion of Esau's family. And you look at it and you say, well, let's just get through these readings. Like, what are we doing here? Like, I usually speak about the reading. What am I going to say about this one? A bunch of Esau's family who were kings. Now what? What do you do with this? Like, what's the instruction? And now we have a beautiful instruction. This teaching, before we get into all of the trials and tribulations and the life and times of Jacob's family, we first have Esau's family. Because that's the way things appear. That's the way things are revealed. Esau comes first. He was born first. His family history with the kings, they are monarch. Their monarchy is established before the Jewish monarchy. In history, there was no Jewish king. That's what the Torah says. These kings ruled before any Jewish kings ruled. Before King Saul or King David, they ruled. And then you might think to yourself, oi, so what chance do we have? There's an essence reality here, and it's not the apparent reality. We just have to know it and to live it. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies on the Beltline. Thank you.